Welcome to the Grazing Grass Podcast, episode 99.
Make sure that what you're doing is moving you towards the goal of what you want.
You're listening to the Grazing Grass Podcast, helping grass farmers learn from grass farmers. And every episode features a grass farmer and their operation. I'm your host, Cal Hartich. You're growing more than grass. You're growing a healthier ecosystem to help your cattle thrive in their environment. You're growing your livelihood by increasing your carrying capacity and reducing your operating cost. You're growing stronger communities and a legacy to last generations. The grazing management decisions you make today impact everything from the soil beneath your feet to the community all around you. That's why the Noble Research Institute created their Essentials of Regenerative Grazing course to teach ranchers like you easy-to-follow techniques to quickly assess your forage production and infrastructure capacity in order to begin grazing more efficiently. Together, they can help you grow not only a healthier operation, but a legacy that lasts. Learn more on their website at noble.org/grazing. It's noble.org/grazing. On today's episode, we have Bodhi Wilmont from Australia. We're talking about his journey. He's in early days of it. My daughter will laugh because I said early days. Anyway, he's getting started there just a few years in. He's battling lantanas. It's an invasive weed there. A very interesting episode. I think you'll enjoy it. He is grazing multiple species or trying to and getting started. Before we get to Bodhi, 10 seconds about my farm. And we're just going to talk just a little bit about the podcast. We are quickly approaching 100 episodes, which is a very exciting benchmark for me. When I started this out, I wasn't sure we would ever get there. And I'm just amazed we're almost there, and we have a very special guest for that 100th episode that you'll have to tune in next week to find out who it is. Enough about that. Let's talk to Bodhi. Bodhi, we want to welcome you to the Grazing Grass Podcast. We're excited you're here today.
Thanks, Cal. It's awesome to be here. I listened to all the episodes, and it's pretty cool to be on one of them.
I appreciate you joining us today. And you're joining us from a long ways away, so we'll talk about that more in just a minute. Just get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your operation.
Thanks. So I'm Bodhi Wilmont. I'm 34 years old. My wife and I have a small farm in just outside of Ipswich in Queensland, Australia. So we're probably 45 minutes from Brisbane, which is on the east coast of Australia. We moved here just about 2.5 years ago, and I wanted a farm since I was 6 years old. So this was a 26-year dream for me. And when it finally happened, that was a pretty awesome day. And then we moved onto the farm, and well, what do we do now? Where do we start? And okay, well, what do you want to do with the farm? It's like, well, I've always wanted to have cattle. I used to play Lego with my brother when I was a kid, and we'd have cattle all over the place, and you'd build ranches and stuff. So I started learning about that. I've got one cousin with a property reasonably close to me, and he pointed me in the direction of a few resources to, when I was asking, like when I was trying to find out what to start with. And the first one that I listened to was Gabe Brown's Dirt to Soil. And I rabbit holed pretty hard. It was all I could think about. It was all I could dream about. It was all I could talk about. And that led me from Gabe to Johann Zeitzman's Man, Cattle, Felt. And the hole just got deeper. And from there, we went to Alan Savory's Holistic Management. And that was how I went from what would essentially be a conventional farming concept to someone who's never done it to this regenerative process. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to run this in a regenerative manner rather than just go hard, wreck the land, leave it, to go so sad. So we're trying really hard to leave it in better condition than when we got it, which wouldn't be hard. We've got a 105 acres, really heavily timbered in hardwood gum. At the moment we farm lantana more than anything else. Now, I'm not sure if you know what lantana is, but it's a noxious weed that has national significance. It's toxic to cattle, it's toxic to sheep. We lost half our first herd to lantana, and once they get it, you just got to watch them die over a week and a half. And it's incredibly difficult to get rid of. It has like a seeding cycle of 7 years, you know, so you get rid of this year's and it's back up next year, and you get rid of that and it's back up the year after that. So it's really difficult to get rid of, especially when you're limited on funds. It's all well and good if you just want to get helicopters in to spray the lot, but it's still going to come up next year anyway, and you paid a couple of grand for a helicopter. So we have 105 pretty average acres. It's in holistic management, it'd be an 8 or 9 on a brittleness scale. It recovers really quickly with rain. We've not long come out of some really dry period. We had less than an inch of rain in 6 months, and it was just barren as anything. And in 1 month, it had neat eye grass. But once it starts to dry off, it drops off to dry and barren pretty quickly. So what we can carry at the moment, I've just been out clearing fence lines, and it's probably chest high grass. And what we can carry stock wise on that versus when it's dry, it's a tenth. So we can probably support 20 head at the moment, but but long term, two. So that's been a real challenge, is trying to work out what the right number for me is. And where we had 15 head for a while, and we're back down to 8 at the moment, and that seems a bit manageable at the moment. Yeah. So we run cattle. We've got a couple of pigs. We've got a couple of goats, and I've got a design, and I'm trying to find a trailer for a little chicken trailer. And the whole concept here is I want to have cattle that are resilient to their environment without me having to pour thousands of dollars into it, because I just don't have it. At the end of the day, once you do become a producer, like at the moment we're just producing for our own family, but once you do produce, every dollar you put into it comes off your profit margin. So it's all well and good to have high quality cattle that look really amazing on a nice grassy paddock, but you've got to put thousands of dollars into them. I don't want to do that. So we have cattle, we have goats for the weed, but unfortunately the goats don't eat the lantana. They can tolerate a lot more of it, but the ones that we've had seem to just leave it alone. Since got pigs. We were out for lunch with a friend one day, and he just said, "Hey man, I've got some piglets. You want some piglets?" Okay, sure. Cool. So now we've got 3 piglets and trying to work out how to raise them. So what we're doing with the pigs is we have them out in pasture, and I mulch, stick rake and mulch the lantana, and then put them in there, and they dig up all the roots and they pee on it and shit on it and fertilize it and till it all up a little bit, and then we oversow it with a pasture mix over that. We've heard about camels eating lantana, so that might be something that I could can look into in the future. But I've heard you say that I've got a few fingers and a few pies, so maybe camels is something I don't need to do at the moment.
Right, yeah. Run that by your wife. Now, you mentioned your wife. Is she from a farming background? She grew up in city?
No. Nah.
What's her thoughts on this journey?
She's got even less farming background, but she doggedly supports my dream, and she does an amazing job of keeping the house running so that I do what I do out there.
Oh, yeah.
We've got an 8-month-old baby, so that takes up most of her time at the moment. But very, very soon we'll be able to do this together, which I'm really looking forward to that. I wanted this, but I didn't want to do it on my own, so I'm looking forward to being able to spend time with her out there. My dad helps a lot. He's not from farming either, but, you know, I said, "Oh, hey, Dad, listen to this book about Gabe," and next thing, he's down the rabbit hole with me. So he's probably worse than me. He'll ring me up at 9:30 at night going, "Oh, I just listened to this YouTube video," or "Oh, I just read this," or "Oh, I just thought, oh, we could try that."
So, very good.
You know, he's mad keen on it as well, and I'm very lucky. He does a huge amount of work for me, so not much more than a rum and coke and dinner.
So. There you go. You can't beat that.
Yeah, he's the cheapest labor I've ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you said lantana. I pulled it up here. It's a flowering plant.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Central and South, and I guess you're lucky you've got it there too.
Yeah, it starts, it has running roots, and you'll pull sections up and the root just pulls up 10 feet down the road, and there's another one over there that's connected to it. It's branches, they're not thorny, but you need gloves to grab them and hang on to them. They're kind of really rough and they'll rip you up. And it can be little shrubs, and it ends up in massive thickets that you can't drive a tractor through it. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It has a really nasty tendency of setting down roots in amongst rocks or logs or piles of crap that you can't get to the root to pull it out. So it's self-protective mechanisms are well developed.
Oh yeah, it sounds like it, self-preservation.
And it's got a toxic. I think blackberries kind of get a bit like that, but maybe not so toxic to the stock. I'm not sure.
The goats love blackberries.
Yeah.
I love blackberries, so you know.
Yeah. That's it. Well, where this stuff has I think it's the chloroform that cattle can't process. And so because they can't process it, it just comes out of their cells and just starts melting them from the inside. If you get it really early, you can give them some charcoal, but for the most part, they either will get through it if they can eat and drink, which they don't want to because they feel sick, so they just die.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard. We got our first herd. We got 8 little Sandy Gertrudis Angus cross weaners, and we lost half of them in the first 2 weeks to land tunnel. Oh. So that was a really hard learning curve.
Sure, and that hurts whenever you're trying to get started.
Well, I'm so sick of shooting and burying my cows, mate. Everything that we do since that has been, how do we avoid that, or how do we avoid the similar thing that's like that? So we got some goats. My wife came home one day and said, "Oh, hey, I've got a friend that wants to get rid of some goats," and she found them on a rescue page on Facebook. And you know, so I had a very short amount of time to clear a paddock and put wire mesh up, and then the goats arrived the next day. And I spent the next 8 months just trying to clear paddocks and fence and keep ahead of them because, hurry up, those boys could eat.
Yeah. And you said goats can tolerate it a little bit more, but they're not real big fans of it.
Correct. Yeah. My understanding is that their rumen can tolerate 5 times as much. It's still toxic, but the concept being that if they have other forage, they will be fine.
Right.
But the goats that we've had are just don't eat it. So, I mean, I can't blame them. It's toxic, but it would be nice if they did eat it.
Yeah. And when you talk about your 100 and some acres there, are you seeing the lantanin all over it? Or is it?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty prevalent. The paddock that's in front of our house, when we lost that first half of the herd, I got some friends and my family around and we ripped it out by hand with a mattock. And filled 3 big trailers full, and it worked. I think I've had 2 shrubs come back up since, and that would be nearly 2 years ago. So it works, but incredibly labor intensive over 2 acres. You know, you can't do that for the other 98, you know.
Well, you'll be finished in 100 years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I'll start on the next project then. Yeah.
Right.
So it worked, but how do we come up with a better idea? So the next thing was a stick rake on my tractor, or was a flail mower. I think you guys call that a brush hog.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So we got a brush hog, and that worked really well, and it does a good job. And then we were cruising along up a hill one day, and there was an almighty bang, and it just catastrophically failed. And essentially, what happened is one bolt came loose, and then a lot of bolts came loose.
We were just
working the thing far too hard. So I got it fixed, and they said, "Oh man, you should put a stick rake on." And this stick rake is like a big Mad Max style bull bar on the front end loader of the tractor. So that the combination of those two really works really well. The stick rake protects the flail mower from big logs and rocks going through it, but I can dig it in dig the tines underneath the crown of the lantana, and then you kind of push up a little pile, lift your loader up, drive over it, and mulch it all. Because I find that the little shrubs, the stick rake won't lift it up. They're not big enough. And the mower leaves the roots in. So the two of them together work really well. But it's slow. it's still labor intensive. You're burning diesel, and it's hard work on the gear. And so then I was at a local Landcare Group festival one day, and I was talking to those guys, and they mentioned a fella that's up on the north coast of Brisbane who uses pigs to clear lantana. So I read into that, and he doesn't use pigs to clear lantana. He uses them to help manage lantana. So he mulches them, and then they get in and dig up all the roots. So it's a better version of managing your pasture and improving than just mulching it. It's just a multifaceted plan on how do we clear these paddocks and get them usable. Now, when I say we've got 105 acres, when we bought the place, there was probably only 30, maybe 40 acres usable. We had one paddock down the back that was just head-high weeds, no grass in it. And that was the one that the goats first went into. And then the paddock next to that, the boundary fence along that whole boundary was ceremonial at best. Yeah. And I spent 3 months clearing the fence line so that I could get to it. And it looks like a highway now, but I mean, there are big trees to get rid of. You couldn't see through the scrub just to get to the fence. So we cleared it, and then we pulled it out and then put in a brand new fence. And now that's another 15 acres. So that between those two paddocks, that's 21 more acres that I have usable than I did last year. Yeah. So that's 50% more land. I've not long finished another paddock, and it's almost 10 acres. We've still got one up behind the shed that I haven't fenced yet. So by the time I'm finished fencing the boundaries, I will have 100% more usable land than when we bought the property. You could just put the stock in it. Then we've got to improve it.
Oh, yeah. It's a process, isn't it?
That's it.
What kind of fence are you putting up?
I've got a lot of, so the boundary fences are split posts with barbed wire, and I don't know whether you guys do split posts, but they're
old steel T post.
Yeah, these are a timber post that you rip with a chainsaw and bore a big hole through them. Again, labor intensive, pretty old school with iron bark, and they last a very long time, but it's still timber in the ground. Your locust post, you guys call them locust posts or something?
Yeah, we have locust posts. And people use that in my area a lot more, hedge apple or Osage orange or Bodark post, except you got to get them straight enough that they'll stick out of the ground straight. They're kind of crooked growing.
That's it. Well, iron bark's definitely not the straightest growing trees, but if you get them at the right age at the right part of the tree, you can get a billet of posts out of, I mean, we cut them at 7 foot. And then your end posts are at 8 foot. And so a good billet, you might get 8 post out of one billet, and if you can get 3 billets out of a tree, then you're not wasting your effort on only getting a small amount of posts out of one tree.
Again,
it's hard work. You need a big chainsaw. I taught myself how to do it, and I cut 80 nearly 90 posts to do that fence line, and it looks really good. And now I've gone, that's really labor intensive. I'm going to do round posts, end assemblies, and T posts, we call them star pickets. So they're similar. They're very similar. So when we bought the place, the boundary fencing was split post with 4 strands barbed wire. And I'm running around now and putting in a ground wire and putting mesh for the goats. And it just means that the property is more valuable because the fencing can hold more than just cattle. So even though it's expensive stuff and even though it's labor intensive, it just improves the value of the property. So I'm prepared to do it. We started off buying hinge joint. I don't know whether you guys have hinge joint mesh, but it's just a prefabricated.
Yeah.
So we had goats, and I spent the first 3 weeks unsticking goats' heads out of the hinge joint.
Yeah.
So they'll push their head through, and then the horns will stop them getting back.
Right.
So we went to a different style of mesh. It's called field fence, but it's 4 foot high. It has 13 horizontal strands and 13, all the vertical strands create a 4-inch square. So that's a tied knot. So the wire doesn't separate, and the square is small enough that goats can't put their head through. Oh. And we haven't had any head sticking issues since then.
Yeah. We put up a little bit of that 4x4. We've also done some goat field wire where they've got the stays are much further apart. We just bought some that we're putting up right now, and it's got 12-inch stays. I think the other fence I have, they may be 15-inch stays because it's just more room in there. Goat sticks their head in. they can pull their nose back out and get their horns out.
Yeah. Maybe that's the go, that if they get stuck, they can get unstuck. Or you got to stop them getting stuck.
Yeah, I really like the goat wire because it's cheaper than that 4x4 wire. That 4x4 wire is expensive.
I buy a whole pallet of it, and I end up getting just over one roll for free. I got a good deal there, but it's still 100 Australian for 50 meters. So do the conversion there. It's, you know, you put up a 400 meter fence. It's expensive.
Oh yes, yeah,
yeah.
Well, I'm so good with these conversions. I'm gonna use my computer to get it to feet. So 164 feet. Okay, so we buy rows. Our rows are usually, I want to say 330.
But yeah.
Now that I say that, I'm like, I could be wrong on that.
Some products are available in 330 in 100 meters, but the roll ends up really heavy and you're flat out lifting it. Yeah. So you got more wire means the roll's is heavier. So you're flat out lifting it. And if you keep it to 50 meters, then it's heavy, but I can pick it up myself. I made an attachment for my tractor that holds the roll upright, and I unhook it, hook it onto one end, and then I just drive the tractor along the fence line, and it unrolls. And over that 50 meters, I strain it twice. So I'll drive out roughly half, strain it up, hook it onto the fence, drive out the other half, hook it on, then connect my new roll, and then drive forward, strain that on. So I'm getting pretty good at it now. I can do a couple of hundred meters in a few hours. On my own. Yeah.
One thing before we leave that goat field wire, whenever you put it up, you got to make sure those stays don't leave a hole next to your post that the goat will get their head caught in.
Yeah, that's it.
Those stays you can tap over, but you've got to check that or you've got to...
I found this fella, he's an Australian guy down in, I think it's Melbourne, that created this product. They're little hooks, and it's just bent wire that creates a loop. It's like a double staple. And you put a roofing screw through, you set it over your wire, and you put a roofing screw into your post, and it just holds it. So, like, they're cheap as anything. Just put I put five over the height of the 12-foot fence and screwed right to the post. I think I've broken. I've snapped one screw and that's into hardwood. So I found that product really cool. Like to bore a 32, which is what's that? That's an inch and a quarter hole. That's a really expensive drill bit and it's a big drill to be able to drill through hardwood. An electric drill will do it, but will it do it four times on every post, times 100 posts, times however many fences you got, you'll burn out a drill pretty quick. So whereas these guys, I just screw a roofing screw in, fences up, I've snapped one screw.
Oh, very nice.
So that's been a real game changer, those guys. They're called, if you want to put them in your notes, they're called Davo's Fencing Clips.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I've moved away from boring holes through timber posts and I use them on my end assemblies. I do a box stay with a cattle rail, screw them on, and then I use star pivots or T-posts in the middle. And I find that with a proper end assembly, the pickets are more than strong enough.
Oh, yeah. Very good. And are you doing, you're talking about you're expanding your area, so you're getting some interior fences done just the way you're expanding.
I'm actually trying not to do too many permanent interior fencing.
Which makes sense.
I'm working towards the idea of this high intensity rotational grazing concept. And I actually asked a question on the grazing grass community the other week and got a variety of answers. And it's all well and good to have daily moves. And I like the concept of it and I understand the reason for it. But, I mean, I work off-farm. I'm self-employed. I'm a carpenter. I come home by 5 o'clock. I work till dark, and then I work all weekend, and I go back to work. I understand that if you have the setup and if you have the labor or if you have the setup or both, it probably is achievable. If you've got a big open paddock and maybe you put a forage crop there or whatever and you just move those step-in posts forward a few feet every day, sure, that's not what I've got. I've got a lot of natural obstacles. We've got gullies. We've got lots of trees.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've got thickets of lantana that will stop you running a fence where you want it to go. You know, just to be able to put up a fence is not as simple as, I'm just going to put up a fence. Yeah, it's great concept, not necessarily applicable in every context.
Your question brought some lively discussion about that on the grazing grass community. And it's all, you know, I think as mentioned, context is so much of it. You know, after a number of years, you get your farm going, you may be able to move closer to those more daily moves. But right now, you know, you've got to take everything in consideration, that holistic approach. And you're working off the farm. And with what you're doing, there's no way I'd be attempting daily moves. Sure, it's a idealized vision in the future. What my suggestion would be, when you got time on the weekend, put up a few paddocks, two or three, and then you can run out there, turn them into the next paddock during the week, because you're coming in, you're tired, you've got an 8-month-old, you got a wife, you've got other demands. You can't just be moving stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I sort of hope this episode is useful for people who are starting out, and the whole episode is going to be, what would you tell somebody just starting out?
Right. You know, yeah.
So we're working on setting up on dividing our big paddocks. Like when I bought the place, it had 4 paddocks, and I've now got 9. So we've already sectioned it up into much smaller areas, and some of those are great now to be able to set up my small internal step-in post paddocks. And that thing that now is nearly a week and a half or 2 weeks feed, is you can have that into 3 lots or 4 lots of 4 days or whatever. Just now, that's what we've started to get to the point where it is achievable to set up small internal daily paddocks. But it's not free, you know. It's not free to have the right stock density. At the moment, I'd love to just, like, I don't have any problems that a few hundred thousand and we wouldn't solve, you know. Just go out and buy the right amount of stock. But they're not free.
Exactly.
They're really expensive. And you can't just trade them left, right, and center. Maybe you can. You have a truck, you can take them to the sale each week, sure. But also, the sale's on a weekday, so that means a day off work. I don't have a truck.
Oh, yeah.
I have a little stock trailer that I can move 3 or 4 head, but not half a herd, you know. And just go and set up some step-in posts. Man, my ground is so hard that you can't step them in. You know, it is hard because it's been so conventionally managed and compacted, and it's quite slopey in areas. So you see a lot of, all the topsoil's gone in areas, and it doesn't look so bad now because it's green. But a lot of what I'm trying to do is get some ground cover, cover the bare areas.
Oh, yeah, because you got to get that ground covered.
Yeah. I bought a little ripper for my tractor recently that we can rip some lines and just start improving it. We had ideas on, you know, you listen to these guys and they talk about swales and contour lines and K-line and this and that. And this is the next thing for what would you tell somebody new, right? Listen to all these guys, these big names, the Gabes, the Alan Savories and all of that, and they talk about these processes. And a lot of them, if you're just starting out, they are decades ahead of where you are. Oh, you know, it's really important that you don't kill the microbiotic life in the soil. Like, man, I haven't got any microbiotic life. it is dead. I drill a fence post hole and it is just hard, hard, compacted crap. So we're a long way before that. It's all a process, and you've got to start somewhere. And for me, starting somewhere is getting the land usable, because where we've opened up the paddocks that couldn't be used for a decade, and now we've got really nice pasture. It's a bit shitty. It's a bit crappy forage, but it's a hell of a lot better than head high weeds.
Oh yeah, it's getting there. And I think you bring up an excellent point there. We have to all be careful about this. And this is, I bring it up on the podcast, you know, we're all on our journeys. Where I'm in my journey is not the same place you are and where
That's
someone
right.
else is. And even if my time frame was the same, there's so much more in that context. What am I working
with? It's incredibly
with?
Important kind of, to,
yeah.
It's incredibly important to apply whatever you do and whatever you listen to and whatever you read and whatever you hear to your context.
Yes.
It might be right for that person, but that person might have half a dozen stock hands. I'm on my own.
Oh, yeah.
It might be right
That'd
for
be
that
nice.
Person. But they've got three generations worth of knowledge that they can fall back on. Sometimes generation knowledge is a problem, as we know, because you get stuck my daddy did this and my granddaddy did this, and that's what we do. But those people might be able to just go and do eight processes you hear in a book, but they've got a 150 horsepower tractor. I don't, you know. So it's incredibly important to apply learning to your context and to what's achievable for you.
Now, you mentioned soil's really hard there. Tell us a little bit about your rainfall there.
I believe our annual rainfall is 980 mil. I looked it up one time, it was a lot. That's
so 40 inches or something.
Correct. But we could get 75% of that in 2 months. The rainfall is quite high, but the distribution is really poor. I mean, I was looking at a photo from the first week of November and then a photo from the first week of December, and that's when the rainfall started. And since the first week of December and we're now, start of March, I've lost count. I stopped counting the rainfall at 500 mil. So we've had well over half our annual rainfall in 3 months.
So, that's what I kind of thought you were working with, a lot of rainfall, and then you get long dry periods.
That's right. Our area is really humid. It's like we can be up in the 30s, sort of low to mid 30s for 5 months of the year, but humidity is really high. Yeah. And it's tough working conditions out there, just sweating through your eyeballs. But, you know, that's a different context to somebody who has frosts. Like we might get one. Right. Or two a year, and it's pretty
bad. Oh, yes.
Where I am. But in a 20-minute drive away, and there's croplands there, and they're in a valley, and they can wreck their whole crop with a frost. You know, so snow, frost, not an issue. Snow, never. Frost, not really for us. High rainfall, but poor distribution.
Two things to know. One thing, you know, Greg Judy talks about tread and post. And he takes his post and he puts a point on the end of them. He says he needs it for his ground up there. I hate to, this may be me doing a humble brag. I don't have to put any points on my tread ends to get them in the ground. Sure, during the summer, it may be a little hard, but it's never terrible. It's never like I hear other people. So I don't know if the point will help you. Putting a point on those may go in a little bit better. But the other thing, when I was looking up stuff, we had John Lackey on here on like episode 7, and he's down by Melbourne. And I thought, well, how far is it from Melbourne to Brisbane? It's like 17 hours.
Yeah, it's a solid 2-day drive.
I thought, it's a few hours away. The scope is beyond me. I was quite shocked by that. That's a long ways away. So much bigger area. And then as I read more on Queensland, I believe it's 2.5 times the size of Texas.
And we're at the very southern edge. We're probably maybe an hour and a half from the southern border of Queensland. It'd take you 5 days to drive to the tip. Driving all day, every day. It's a big area. I mean, Australia is a big country. We're not just some little Pacific island, you know. We're a big Pacific island that doesn't have many people comparative to Europe and to the US. And I'm going to quote a stat that's absolutely just made up on the spot, but 90% of them live on the coastal fringes, you know. So that that creates problems where you go out west and you just can't get stuff because it doesn't exist there. Or if it does, it's got to be on a road train that takes a couple of weeks to get out to you, you know. But we don't have that problem where we are. We're only an hour from Brisbane. We got plenty of supplies that we can just go down the shop and get them.
Well, I just want to point out how ignorant I was, because I knew Australia was big, but when I did that little Google map, I was like, whoa, that's way bigger than I even thought.
It's a big place. It takes a long time to get anywhere. When I was a child, we lived in Ireland for 9 months, and you fly into Dublin. We was living in Tipperary, which is, I think it was an hour and a bit south of Dublin. you can drive from the top to the bottom in about 3 hours. You know, oh, yeah. 3 hours doesn't get you far in Australia at all.
Well, this is off topic, but we'll chase this for just a moment. I don't know that I mentioned this on the podcast. I know I was talking on a different podcast and I talked about this. My wife's from Hawaii, and she, if it's not within 15 minutes of the house, she's like, that's too far to go. And I'm not, you know, we're not that far out in the country, 15 minutes to the nearest town, which is a couple thousand people. It's an hour to a big city. But, you know, just that change in thought pattern. She makes fun of me still yet because when I go to town, I try and hit up every store because Dad was very adamant we're not wasting gas and going to town multiple trips. In her mind, if we run in town this morning, we can go this afternoon. It's not a big deal. It's just a different mind shift there, especially when you're considering a much bigger area.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Totally non-relevant topic on the Grazing Grass podcast right there.
But fun to talk about.
Yeah. So back to your improvement. You're seeing some improvement in those areas that you've been able to get cleared off and get into production.
Yeah, when we first got the peats, we've just got a little pen that's been really handy that the goats are currently in at the moment. Once I moved them out of that into their first paddock, I'd put the cattle in there, and it's probably only a quarter of an acre, that little section. And I'd put cattle in there. They were in there for 2 days, and they really ate it down, did a good job. The pigs went in there, and then the cattle are into the next one before the pigs. And then the pigs take longer than the cattle do. So by the time the cattle were two paddocks ahead, and they've now gone out the back, the regrowth just in that small area over 2 weeks is unbelievable. It's gone it's gone from sort of hip-high, dry, pretty crappy grass, and it's lush and thick and green. And I know it's the same species, and I know it's not great forage, but the regrowth when you get that high intensity in a small area is unbelievable. I mean, it's good growing at the moment and whatever, but I can absolutely anecdotally say that this concept of high intensity, short time, small area works. It's amazing. The density of regrowth is impressive. Like you look over some of the paddocks that haven't been used, and again, it's hip high and whatever. It seems like there's a lot of grass, but you go walking through it and it's bare in between the plant bases.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas once the cattle have been in there and they walk on it and they piss on it and shit on it and they trample some in and they eat it all down and it regrows, and the density of plants in those areas, it would be triple. So it is starting to become hard to find bare areas when I've been able to get that density right down.
Oh, yeah. And I know when you're talking about, first off, it sounds like you need a whole bunch more pigs. Get them out there working for you. Yeah. And then secondly, you know, we had Marcos Jeffries, I believe, on the podcast a long time ago, Alejandro on the podcast, and they're in the Chihuahuan Desert of Mexico, and they're using... Now, they're dealing with much lower rainfall totals for the whole year, but they deal with that long dry period, and they're using long, long rest periods to get their grass. And they're grazing really mature grasses, but they're letting those rest periods dictate that, so they have coverage out there and get to everything.
Yeah. We've only had the pigs for a few months, and everything that I do, I'm just trying to dabble in it until I learn, because we went pretty hard with the cattle and lost half of them, and it was expensive. The second lot of cattle, we've lost a few of them for really unfortunate reasons as well. And I mean, we spent almost $2,000 on the Brahmins that we have now, and we lost two of them. That's $4,000. If I lose these three pigs, it's $180. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to learn when it doesn't cost me too much if it fails.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's been a few months and they're going really well. They're not getting fat, but they are happy and they're doing a good job. I mean, our neighbor said, oh man, we had pigs, and you know, make sure you don't feed them all the time because they'll get fat and you don't want that. And I'm probably gone a little bit too far the other way. So at the moment I'm feeding them up a bit of grain while we're just learning. But I actually have an appointment with that farmer that I was telling you about that does the pigs and the lantana.
Oh, he's
in the middle of yeah, I'm going to go up and meet him and just see what he's doing. And he, I think he runs Berkshires up there. So it'd be nice to learn a bit from him after he's a few years ahead of me and see what we can pick up. Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about, you know, advice to someone just getting started. So often that advice is find someone doing what you want to do and go visit them and see what they're doing. So I think that's a great move on your part.
Yeah, that's it. And this is something that gets said a lot. Find a mentor. That's not that easy. Find a mentor that does what you want to do. Okay, awesome. I'll just go and meet Alan Savory. It's not that easy to get a mentor. I haven't found it that easy. Maybe if you've got the history in the industry, maybe it would be easier. Maybe you've got the connections. Maybe you know somebody who knows somebody. But for me, I've not found it easy to find a mentor. And so my mentors are YouTube and your podcast and audiobooks.
and I think that's great. And when I start the podcast, that's part of the reason I had. Who around me is doing what I want to do? I know these people are out there doing it, but where are they? Now,
that's it.
Actually, through the podcast, I found some people that are local to me doing this that were just a few miles away that I never knew they were.
The group is only based half an hour away, and obviously all the people live pretty close. So I became a member of that, and I love the Grazing Grass community discussion page. And so I'm trying to get them to create that because their Facebook page, it needs to be reasonably professional and you can't just have people having a conversation on their Facebook page. Whereas if we had that discussion group, that'd be awesome.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what we're working on getting Landcare to get that to happen. Yeah.
And that's one of the goals of that Grazing Grass community, you know, have these discussions with people you may not be able to have discussions with near you, have conversation. I would love to figure out some way that we had maps or you know, listing of people willing to help people because, you know, in the go, we're all in this together. If we can just help one another, it would be great.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I get a lot of help from the podcast and from these books, and so we're trying things like using electric fences instead of permanent fences for the internals, and that works really well. Like, you know what a good thing about electric fences? It's portable. If you put it up and it's in the wrong spot, pull it out, put it somewhere else. I mean, that boundary that I put in with the split post, it was so labor intensive, and it's a big, heavy attachment for the tractor that's incredibly dangerous. You can put them up everywhere and then you decide, you know what, I don't want that fence there. Oh, it's staying there because it's in. Whereas you just pull a star picket out, you know. And the electric fences are, it might be right for when you put it in, but 1 or 2 years down the track and now it's in the wrong spot because you might have put water over there or whatever. You might have put a gate in here and now it's just in the wrong spot. Just pull it out, move it wherever you want. I mean, electric fences are just incredibly valuable to be able to push stock and hold stock where you want them. And I mean, I've got kilometers of that stuff.
Oh yeah. Electric fence allows us to do so much that we couldn't do before. And those energizers, so much better than the energizers back in the '80s. These will turn animals, which is nice.
We use a Gallagher MBS 100. I've got four of them. They're a multi-powered unit, so you can run them off mains, you can run them off solar, or you can run them off a 12-volt battery.
Yeah.
So I just have old marine deep cycle batteries that didn't work in the ute anymore, but they're still perfectly good for an electric fence. So an old clapped out deep cycle battery will run an electric fence for a week easy. I've got one new battery and that thing goes for ages. So I just find them really versatile. The batteries are heavy, but I can put it in a quad bike and take it wherever I want in the farm.
Yep.
Whereas, like, I've been really tempted to try the JVA fencing. They've got a solar powered unit, has a small 18 volt lithium battery, kind of like a motorcycle battery that's in it. Yeah. They're a little bit more expensive than the Gallagher ones I use, but I just feel a little bit like if something's not broken, don't change it. And solar is great, but you know when solar's not going to work? When I try it and it's going to be cloudy for a week and then it's chaos around. You know, so I get a little bit what I know I use what I know works.
I actually think that's a very important concept that we can get caught up into and I'm as guilty as anyone. Oh, this is going to work so much better. So I need to try it. If it's working for you, stick with it. I have a couple
but at the same time, don't be so closed-minded that you can't consider when something might be better.
Well, yeah,
because otherwise, we'd all still be conventionally farming, you know.
True. Yeah, I concede that. You know, if there's some benefit to be gained there, but at the same time, don't just run out and change stuff. I know I've got a little Gallagher. I want to say like a S100. It's not very powerful. My dad had bought it, and I actually end up using it when I need to throw up a short fence. Now, it will not handle a great load, but if I just need to put up a single strand, split a pasture in half, on my dad's place, we have a lot more permanent interior fences. So those paddocks are in place. I can split them up and do more with that. I actually have it running one of my bigger fences right now because I've got an energizer that's quit and I got to get it repaired. But I went and visited a farm not too far from me. Like I'd mentioned, I found a people in the same county as me doing this, and I went and visited him. And that's all he runs. All he runs. I'm like, that doesn't work for me. I mean, it works in these isolated spots, but he's also doing a little bit different. I've got some sheep and goats. I put up some netting sometimes, and that netting will zap an energizer if it's not enough power on it.
We want to talk about zapping. I got myself pretty good yesterday on the electric fence. I set up a pump to be able to fill my water trailers, and right next to it, I've got an electric fence, and I turned the fence off when I was in there just in case or whatever. Well, at least I thought I did. And I finished running the suction pipe and putting the float out there, I thought, I've always wanted to move that isolator up because when the dam is full, it is in the water. So I just went over there to lift it up. I was already wet, you know, and I touched that pulley wire, and that got me real good.
Bit you good, yeah.
Yeah, not only are you touching it, but you're in the water and you're wet, and I jumped pretty high.
Oh, I imagine so. Speaking of water, how's your water on your place?
We got a lot of water. So we're back onto a quarry, and the old owner of our property owns the land that that quarry is on, and they lease it from him. He broke off the 105 acres that we had when he needed downsize his assets a little bit. And a few decades ago, that quarry put in this dam for their use, and then there was a dispute, and now he doesn't let them use it anymore. So when we bought it, we got this big dam, and it's 25 million litres. It's a big dam.
Oh, wow.
We also have three other smaller dams that are around about a million litres each. So we've got a lot of water storage, but water in a dam is only so useful. Stocking. So we're doing a lot to try and get the water on the ground and keep it on the ground instead of just sitting in a tank, you know.
No, Yeah.
I've just started making these little water trailers, and that has just been game changing for me. I mean, we've been so limited in where I can put the stock because the stock had to be able to access a dam, and fencing. I've got fences that run down into the dam, and it's a pain because pretty quickly our cows learned that they could just go around the end of it and then they'd be off where they wanted to go. Fencing, and our dam is shaped. If you dropped a cup full of paint on the floor, that's what our dam is shaped like. It's not easy to easy to fence off, you know. Whereas these water trailers, I can put the water wherever I want, and in general, they would prefer to drink water out of a trough than get their feet wet if they don't have to.
Oh, yeah.
So not only has it allowed me to have water every single part of my property, they will prefer to stay near the water rather than wander back and use, you know, get their feet wet in the dam. So it helps to concentrate their efforts where I want. Helps. Not all of it, but, you know, I can set up one strand of poly wire and have the water cart in there. And as long as I keep it moving, they don't try to get out of that wire too much. And those little water trailers, like, they cost me, they probably didn't even cost $1,000. And I've got two of them. I got one for the pigs. I got one for the cows. And you've got water on every single part of the property, wherever you want at any time.
So does it have a water tank on it, or are you running some pipe to it?
So I think you guys have them. Like, they're a 1,000 liter shuttle. What's that? 330 300 gallons, something like that. So they're a 1,000 litre shuttle. You can buy them off Marketplace or Craigslist or whatever you call it. Companies that import products that bring them in by the 1,000 litre at a time, they've always got them to get an IBC. That's exactly right. IBC. So I buy an IBC and then I've made up a couple of troughs out of like blue drums, 44-gallon drums, cut one in half, make up a bit of a frame, put a float valve in there. And then I usually put a little toolbox on the front that I can, like if you're supplementary feeding them with grain or just treats or whatever it is that you use for your stock, then that can stay in there. You don't have to cart a bucket of stuff from your shed out to wherever your cows are. So, and I buy all of that from Marketplace. So the whole setup is less than $1,000, water anywhere you like. Is it permanent? No. Is it going to handle big stock numbers? No. But even if it just is good for now, to have water everywhere on my property is thousands and thousands of dollars. Like polypipe is expensive, digging it in just even where the gates are. That's expensive. Whereas $2,000, two different livestock groups, water anyway. And is it even if over the decades I put in troughs, permanent troughs, I don't have to have them everywhere. Whereas the water trailers give me the flexibility to hold the stock wherever I want. Yeah, and right, it's scalable. Like if you had a big tractor with a big farm trailer, you could put a big tank on there, I can't pull that giant trailer, but I've only got 8 cows. So, even just a tandem trailer with 2 IBCs would last you twice as long. So it's a scalable concept that doesn't cost you very much.
Yeah, it is. And it gives you that flexibility where you can really target graze an area and keep them confined, whereas you're trying to build lanes or get cows to walk or animals walk back to water.
I actually use the trailers to help move the stock. If I open up the fence, they get very testy about where the fence was and they don't want to come near it. Yeah. Whereas if I just open up the fence and drive the trailer away, they're going, well, where are you going? And I it's not perfect, but I find it helps me to move the stock. Because, I do almost all of it on my own. So if there's a way that I can get them to think it's their idea instead of having to force them, it helps me.
Oh yeah, leading cows are a lot better than pushing.
Yeah, it works really well right up until it doesn't, and it works really well. Moving my cows is easy; I don't have any problem moving them, but I do have a lot of trouble getting them into the yards. They if they start walking that direction, they go. If he goes anywhere near that gate, we're going to go the other way.
Yeah,
and that's where I have trouble on my own.
Have you used your polywire reels to get them into your corrals, into your pens?
I have a setup of fences that allows me to funnel them towards that gate. And if I am in exactly the right spot with my quad, it works pretty well.
Yeah.
And they sort of just go. But I've got 2 cows that are really testy and they will try anything to get away. So if I can not get them leading, then they all sort of follow all right. We've actually just sold them. They've got a truck coming tomorrow and we're going to try a different breed. They're Brahmins and they're just hard work for one guy.
A little bit more high strung.
We're going to try something. Yeah, every time I've talked about it since and you get to old guys and they go, that's Brahmins. I call it fizzy. It's like a Coke bottle. You sit a Coke bottle on a shelf and it's happy ass, but you shake it up and it's fizzy. And when you put when you put Brahmins under pressure, they're fizzy. So, just starting out, don't choose Brahmins. They're hard work.
Yeah, and that's my understanding as well. I can remember when they first came in the country, in the U.S., my grandpa, it wasn't first, in the 70s when they were really doing more exotic breeding, 70s and then early 80s, I know he had a Brahma bull on all his beef cattle. And this bull was as tame as can be. I was just always shocked by how tame he is. But then you get those, at least in my experience, you get those F1s, and when they have a baby, you want to be careful. Now, that's my experience. Other people have other experiences. So,
Cal, do you want to tell your listeners what an F1 is and an F2? Because this is something that you read when you see an ad for Caddy. You're like, F1. What is F1? It's not a race car. So what is F1?
Yeah. Well, when I think of a F1 and I'm thinking of Bramers, most time I'm thinking it's a Braford or a Brawford. It's a half beef breed, half Bramer. Of course, Bramer's beef breed, but it's half that Bramer breed species. Yeah, I was like, I should know those and I can't think of it. And then half a more traditional or exotic breed. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in our area do Herefords and Bramers.
Yeah. I'm trying to find some Droughtmasters. So Droughtmasters are a really popular breed in Australia. They're half Brahman, half Shorthorn. So they're really common, and there's big sales that have a lot of stud diamond genetic type stuff, and they sell for a lot of money. And they reckon they handle the conditions for Australia pretty well, and temperament's supposed to be pretty good too. So I'm gonna try and find a small herd of them. I found it really hard to know what to do, in that it's all well and good to go just buy the best thing that you can, but it's really easy to spend $2,500 on one cow. When you're just starting out, is that the way to go? I don't know. I think, like, if we bought that $2,500 cow and it wasn't from a Lantana area and it had a munch, that'd be $2,500 gone.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So the first ones that we bought, they were just under $1,200 each. So it was an expensive loss to lose four of them. That's nearly $5,000, but it's better than $10,000. So I think if you're just starting out, I think it's really important to just have a go, because you're going to mess up. You're going to make mistakes. Even if you don't make mistakes, things are going to go wrong, and you don't want it to bankrupt you because you made a mistake or something went wrong just because shit goes wrong, you know. So have a go, and try and have a go with something that doesn't cost you too much when you do it.
And, you know, that's excellent. But Rob Dondal said a few weeks ago on the podcast, you know, work with those standard animals, things that's pretty common, till you understand what you're doing before you start getting into some of that expensive stuff. And yeah, I think that's great advice. And also, when you think about that, you mentioned it earlier with your pigs, but pigs and goats are a lot cheaper to learn on than cattle.
Yeah,
and sheep's the same way.
Yeah. I haven't gone down the line of sheep, but the goats are a bit good. They're a difficult animal to manage, in that I kind of liken it to cats and dogs. Dogs are reasonably trainable. Cats will not interested in. And I have found the goats not overly trainable. But, I mean, there's great videos of people that the goats know exactly what to do. So I think they're just a bit different. And they are cheap to buy, but the fencing is not cheap. So that's something to consider too.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, if you've got 10 acres, then yeah, sure, give them a go. But if you've got 100 acres to fence, that there's a lot of money there.
Yeah, sheep's got a little bit of that advantage of being lower cost, and the fencing not as expensive as for goats. But as you mentioned, sheep, goats, cattle, they just handle so differently. The herding instinct, flocking instinct. Yes. And I don't know if I've said this. I liken it, you know, you drive cattle and they go around the pond and you can get them and you drive them up to where you need them to be. With sheep, you may go around the pond 100 times. It just doesn't stop.
Yeah.
You do it with goats, they go behind the pond dam and they hide from you and peek out every once in a while. So they're just totally different in handling of them.
Yeah. We've just got some new goats out. The ones that we had were really good, but they were all weathers, so they would never breed, obviously. And they were a British Alpine cross. So they'd stand up on a 4-foot fence and their head is level with me. You know, they're big, tall, rangy boys, but very little meat on them. So they're good at browsing, not good for producing anything. So we had them for a few months until they were eating quicker than I could fence, and it started getting real dry, and we ended up selling them. We had two rangelands. I don't know whether you get them there, but I think they're a little bit of an Australian cross that has become its own breed now. And those two girls, they were just hard work, mate. So they've made some pretty tasty curry and stews for the last few months. We've now got two boar does and a Kalahari buck, and we've only had them for a short time. So unfortunately, these guys, I think they came from a lady who treated them like pets, and they came in every night and they got pellets and they got grass, and I mean, I put these guys in that little pen full of weed and they didn't even know what to do with it. So it's been a bit of a rough learning curve for them going, I'm not feeding you until you start eating the weeds. And and just in the last week, they've started eating the weeds. So there's, but there was weeks worth of, I don't think these goats know how to go. So I'm about ready, just when I can get around to finding the time to move them off into one of the paddocks and just see how they go. And if not, then we'll either sell them or put them in the freezer.
Oh, yeah. And they'll probably come around and figure it out. But, yeah, there's a lot of pampered goats around here as well.
There is. Yeah.
Well, Bodie, we probably need to go ahead and wrap this up and move on to our famous four questions. Same four questions we ask of all of our guests. But, however, before we get there, is there anything else you would like to cover before we move on?
I guess over grazing topic, we didn't so much specify that that's what we're talking about, but what we're trying to do on our property is using the livestock as the driving force in clearing scrub. It's not the only thing we do. We do a little bit of poison, but I don't like using poison because it's not overly effective and it kills everything else and you end up having to go back and do something else anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So if I can use the cattle to clear the decade-old, oxidized, low nutritional value forage so that I can see the obstacles. And then I can get in there and I can put up a proper fence and we can clear the crap and we can, you know, get through the lantana with a brush hog and the pigs and the goats can eat whatever it's left. And all of a sudden you've now got three different species worth of piss and shit on it. And you've walked in it, you've trampled it, and now that whole paddock is usable again. The chickens, they're going to follow along too, because I want them in their little trailer to follow the cattle so that they eat the parasites that affect that. Because if I don't have to buy a chemical to manage the parasites on my cattle, and in the meantime I have a livestock that produces eggs and it's worth money or potentially worth money, that's better than spending money on chemicals. It's better for the land. It's better for me. We get the little kickback of having your own eggs. Same thing. Like we haven't done bacon yet, but I'm pretty excited about getting some bacon I grew. You know, and goat curry and stew is amazing. When we put our first few steers in the freezer, and like, we haven't bought beef in months. That was just an awesome day. You go, you know, I grew that. I knew exactly what's in that. We don't sell it yet. We don't produce anything yet, but in a few years' time, we'd like to. But at the moment, just producing food for my family has been a really, really cool thing. So if we try to clear crappy scrub with animals, with livestock as your driving force, instead of just going, right, how can I spend money on a chemical or how can I spend money on a machine that will do this for me? I think that it leaves us in a better place than just spending money on a problem.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right with that. Using animals as a tool as a means to get there.
I mean, maybe if you're a millionaire, maybe you've got the money to spend, but I'm not. I mean, I'm farming on a shoestring, mate. I've learned so many different skills since buying our farm because, I mean, I have friends go, man, how are you so good at so many different things? And I'll tell you why, because it's because I'm poor. I don't have the money to pay the right. I don't have the money to pay the right guy. You know, I've learned to drive a bobcat and an excavator, and I've taught myself to drive a tractor. I'm far better at welding than I ever was. I'm a pretty good rural fencer now, and all of these things because you just get in and have a go at it yourself. And before long, you go, I don't need to pay him. I could do it myself.
Oh,
And if I could bring my kids up in that environment, then hopefully my kids end up pretty strong, capable people as well.
Yeah, I think that's great. And we do everything because we're too tight, too broke to spend money on stuff. So, Well, Bodie, it's time for our famous four questions. Same four questions we ask of all of our guests. Our first question, what's your favorite grazing grass related book or resource?
I'm sure everyone says it, but there's a few. Gabe Brown got me into this field, but Alan Savory's Holistic Management really threw me down a hole pretty hard, and that's a lot of what I follow on from. But if I could also add Johann Zeitzman's Man, Cattle, Felt and Matthew Evans' Soil. I don't know if I've heard that one mentioned before, but I really enjoyed Soil.
I don't think I have either.
It was really good. And I listen to audiobooks while I'm working, and I just find it easy to just listen to it again, go back, redo another chapter. And then the other one, which I know has been mentioned, was Call of the Reed Warbler by Charles Massey. And that I think Massey and Matthew Evans really highlight the state that our world is at, and we're in a pickle if we don't change how we do things. Yeah, so they're probably my favorites, those ones.
Oh yeah. Very good choices. I'm not familiar with the Matthew Evans one, so I'll have to look that up. My wife will be so excited. I'll be buying another book. Our second question. What is your favorite tool for the farm?
I'm a little bit ashamed to say it, but my little tractor is my favorite tool.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing regenerative stuff, and something that burns diesel is probably not the best choice, but man, it is so handy. It's a little Chinese imported brand. I spent about $27,000 on a 55 horsepower tractor, plus a few extra grand for some other attachments and stuff. And it has not done anything that it hasn't been able to. Sorry, it's done everything that I've asked of it. It works far harder than I think. I think I work it to the very extent of its design. But I mean, I feed cattle with it. I clear land with it. I can lift heavy stuff with it. I can move things around. You can, you know, unbulk something with it. Like I would be lost without my little tractor, and I do a lot of work with it. And I have a carryall that I made that we do a lot of fencing with that carryall. It's just a really handy, really versatile tool that, yes, it burns diesel, but otherwise it's a really handy little thing. And I mean, it's not a Case or a John Deere or a New Holland. It's just a cheap little tractor that does a really good job.
You know, on that subject, we talk about, you know, grazing can have a pretty low price point to get started. Get you some energizers, some poly braids, some kind of reel. You can get out there and start doing it. I have a hay unroller we built because we didn't want to spend the money for one. It works okay. But, you know, I was feeding hay the other day, putting out some bales for bale grazing and putting up paddocks. We're almost at the end of that season. Grass starting to grow here. But I was doing that with our tractor. And I was thinking about that as I'm doing it, because I'm thinking, you know, I could get by without this tool, but I really like having that tool.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we do a lot with our little tractor. I've made a number of attachments for it that make life easy for myself. Like I can do a lot of fencing myself with some attachments that I've made.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Could you ram the star pickets in yourself? Yes, I could. But the frame that holds the picket driver that I just drive along 5 paces, put another picket in, you know, I can put up 300 meters in an hour on my own. You can't do that.
Hell yeah.
Ramming it in by hand, you know, so could you get by? Yes, but I really would like not to.
Yeah. Well, and like we mentioned earlier, context is so much of it. You have off the farm job as well as trying to do this. Some of those labor saving items really goes back to that time management for you, so you can have time to do everything that you're trying to do.
Yeah,
you know, it's all about that context.
Time management is poor for me at the moment. I think I was in before dark maybe 5 times last year, so I need to do better than that this year. Yeah, I probably work too hard at all these different things, and yeah, is the job still going to be there tomorrow? Well, maybe sometimes you got to leave it for tomorrow.
And I hate to admit this. I will go ahead and admit this. I try and be pretty open about any of my struggles and everything. I just had a low gear day. I complained to my wife. I didn't get anything accomplished. I was not motivated today. And she's like, and this is where I struggle. She's like, that's okay. You don't have to be going all the time. But for me, the thought is I should be out doing something. I've got hundreds of things to do. I need to be doing it.
That's it. So my wife says the same thing to me, and I like the idea of sitting around doing nothing, but in an hour or two I'm starting to look for something to do.
Yeah, or I'm looking on Marketplace and I've about bought a new project, so you know, go figure.
That's right. Yep.
Our third question, it's kind of been the topic throughout, but what would you tell someone just getting started?
It absolutely has been the topic throughout, but I think get a mentor. But try things yourself. Buy the best thing you can afford at the time, it might not be the best, but but if you buy the best thing that you can afford at the time, you won't be disappointed. But don't buy something that's too expensive, because something will go wrong and then it'll break or it'll die, you know. So what it really comes down to is make sure that you do a context check with what you do. Does it fit your context at the time, or does it fix your context on where you want to be? Just get in and have a go. Like, can you weld? I don't know. Give it a crack. Learn. Just, there's so much resources out there. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Like, this world is too hard to live on your own. Ask for help. Yeah. All of these things, I think, are important. Now, when you're starting out, just get in, have a go, have a crack. See how you go. Be prepared to make mistakes, because you will. Make sure that when you do anything, assess it and see whether it was a success. Was it a failure? Well, did it fail for the reasons that you thought it did? You know, and try and review these things as the time goes on, going, well, I thought it failed because I ran out of forage, or I thought that thing died because it was sick. Is that actually what happened, or did something else happen? You know, was there another cause for what happened, whether it was a success or a failure, than what you thought it was? And I just think, try not to take everything too seriously. I probably take things too seriously. Just get in, have a go, and see what happens, and try and make sure that what you're doing is moving you towards the goal of what you want.
Excellent advice, and tons of things there to unpack. But I'm just going to unpack one thing out of that, and that's that reflection piece. Because I think that reflection piece is so important, that after you've done it and you've got this result, why did you get that result? Is that what you anticipated? How can you do this better tomorrow? And I know a lot of times we do that just very casually, just as we go through. But sometimes we really need to sit down and think through it and make sure we give it the adequate time that it needs. Because if we don't, we're not improving.
That's it. I was a paramedic before I was a carpenter, before I was a farmer, and reflection on jobs was a really important part of learning. And I've definitely carried that with me through life now. Did I do that right? Or if I didn't, why did that happen? And if I did do that, could it have been better? And was it right for or wrong for the reasons that I thought it was?
Yeah, excellent advice. And Bodie, where can others find out more about you?
I don't have a great deal of social media presence. I've got a Facebook page. That's just a personal page. I'm more than happy for anybody, if they wanted to ask me something or had advice for me or whatever, send me a message. I'd love to, you know, reach out and talk to people about it. It is on our list of jobs to eventually get around to having a farm. We've got a farm name, but to have a farm presence. In the meantime, you know, if you want to look me up on Facebook, I'd love to hear from anybody. But we'll add some social media pages in the future. It'll be Corymbia Farms.
And you're in the grazing grass community, so you're available well.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, Bodie, I appreciate you coming on today and sharing.
Thanks very much, Cal. It's been a pleasure.
Mine as well. I really hope you enjoyed today's conversation. I know I did. Thank you for listening. And if you found something useful, please share it. Share it on your social media. Tell your friends. Get the word out about the podcast. Helps us grow. If you happen to be a grass farmer and you'd like to share about your journey, go to grazinggrass.com and click on Be Our Guest. Fill out the form, and I'll be in touch. We appreciate your support by sharing our episodes and telling your friends about it. You can also support our show by buying our merch. We get a little bit back from that. Another way to support the show is by becoming a Grazing Grass Insider. Grazing Grass Insiders enjoy bonus content, monthly Zooms, and discounts. You can visit the website, grazinggrass.com, click on support, and they'll have the links there. Also, if you haven't left us a review, please do. It really helps us as people are searching for podcasts. And I was just checking them, and we do not have very many reviews for 2024. So if you haven't left us a review, please do. And until next time, keep on grazing grass.